I'm Alistair Campbell from The Rest is Politics.
Anish Kumar here from Pod Save the UK.
And Christiana Figueres from Outrage and Optimism.
Rising inequality, conflict, climate disaster, it's very hard to find reasons to be hopeful about the future.
That's why we're teaming up this September during the 80th General Assembly of the United Nations.
Along with Political Currency, Pod Save the World, The Week Junior, and more.
We'll discuss the stories that give us hope and answer the question, how does hope turn into action?
Look out for the Be Hope Takeover this September.
Moro Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Michael Steele Podcast. I'm Michael Steele. It's a pleasure having you join us today. Today is a sort of a quiet, somber day here at the podcast because of the news of the passing of Elijah Cummings, who represented the great city of Baltimore for over 20 years. And so we'll share a few thoughts about that in a moment. But before we do, I wanted to welcome to the program our guest, Susan Page. She's the Washington Bureau Chief of USA Today. She's covered 10 presidential campaigns, and she must have started this when she was like 18, and six White House administrations, and she's interviewed the past nine presidents. She's the author of The Matriarch, Barbara Bush and the Making of an American Dynasty, and the upcoming Madam Speaker, Nancy Pelosi and the Arc of Power. Welcome, Susan, to the podcast.
Hey, Michael, it's great to be with you.
It is really good to have you. And let's start with Elijah Cummings. He is someone who had become over time a larger than life figure. And certainly, you know, we know him for the battles that he had to engage with Republicans on the committee that he chaired in the House, and certainly the more recent battles with the President of the United States. But he's been in this space quite a while. Tell us a little bit about your experience with him and what you've gotten to know about him.
You know, Elijah Cummings was one of the most senior members of the House. He was there a long time, and that made him notable. But what made him more notable was the alliances and the friendships and the respect that he commanded across party lines. You know, we have fewer and fewer members of Congress in either party about whom that can be said, but it could certainly be said about Elijah Cummings. And you heard it with the news of his passing, with the number of Republicans as well as Democrats who spoke out about his grace and his leadership and the tone he set, a tone of civility and cordiality, yeah, and principle.
Those last pieces of the Elijah puzzle to me are perhaps the most important and the most intriguing at the same time, because in what had become a more toxic, cynical environment, that sense of civility, that appreciation of the institution and what it meant, not just to the members who served in the Congress, but to the people of the United States, to see the body work and function. Yeah, he could throw down with the best of them as a partisan. I've been in that space with him. But he also knew where the water's edge was and tried to bring some civility to the conversation, even in some of the more compelling moments, as he did with that conversation with Mark Meadows, when Meadows was so upset that he'd been called a racist by one of the members, or at least inferred to be a racist by one of the members of the House committee. And Elijah came to his defense in a very public way and got some pushback on it, Susan, you know, back at home. But for him, it was about the principle and about the cordiality that was important as part of your civil service, if you will.
And seeing human beings as human beings, seeing politicians on the other side as a human being worthy of reproach sometimes, but right. also worthy of the assumption of respect. You know, we think also of his words. I think it was in a hearing with Michael Cohen where he talked about when we're dancing with the angels, what will they say that we did for our democracy? That's that paraphrase, not an exact quote, but it was a beautiful statement, and it reflected a willingness to step back from the tumult of the day to look at the bigger picture.
Yeah, it really is a reminder that there's more to this than just the sausage making of politics, that there is a higher order to these things. And at some point, you're going to have to account for it to the voters, to the community, and ultimately with the angels. And it was very profound. We will miss him. And appreciate his leadership and hope that there were those who at least inspired enough to try to emulate it as they search and find their own leadership. Let's move to some of the rough and tumble of the day. There are a couple of things. Wow. I mean, I've got someone like Susan Page here at the podcast, so there's so many places we could go. Let's start with the Democrats and their tete-a-tete again in recent days, the last debate that they had, in which we saw the rise of that mushy middle. Seemed to be a little bit more firm, a little bit more solid, as Biden and particularly Amy Klobuchar, Senator Klobuchar and Mayor Pete Buttigieg really established themselves and their messaging to push back on the narrative that the progressives have begun to not only put out there, but really solidified the Democratic presidential campaign behind. There's one particular moment I want to play for you where Amy Klobuchar, as we like to say in the neighborhood, had a throwdown moment with Elizabeth Warren.
I want to give a reality check here to Elizabeth, because no one on this stage wants to protect billionaires. Not even the billionaire wants to protect billionaires. We just have different approaches. Your idea is not the only idea.
The rich are not like you and me. The really, really billionaires are making their money off their accumulated wealth, and it just keeps growing. We need a wealth tax in order to make investments in the next generation. Look, I understand that this is hard, but I think as Democrats, we are going to succeed when we dream big and fight hard, not when we dream small and quit before we get started.
So you had this incredible setup between these two where Elizabeth was like, you know, you're going after billionaires, but heck, you know, that's not the truth of this storyline. How do you see this playing out? And does it elevate a Klobuchar enough to be credible going forward and see the bounce both in money and polling? And the same with Mayor Pete, who also made it very clear that Elizabeth Warren was not being forthright in her explanation about her health care plan, Medicare for All, which she could not even admit that, yeah, the middle class will pay higher taxes.
You know, that clip is perfect because it really encapsulates the debate in the party. You have Elizabeth Warren saying, let's dream big. And you have Amy Klobuchar saying, let's be realistic. And this is the debate that's going on. And as you know, in either party, it is easier to dream big, to take the most expansive view of whatever position your party is taking, than it is to say, let's be realistic. We need to appeal to swing voters. We're going to have to compromise with the other side. It's hard to be in the middle. But what I think we heard in this fourth set of Democratic debates were, as you say, Amy Klobuchar and Pete Buttigieg trying to make the case that if Democrats want to defeat President Trump, and man, Democrats really want to defeat President Trump, they need to pull back from their biggest aspirations, dreaming big, Medicare for All, the Green New Deal, and think about how you actually win the presidency and are able to achieve maybe less dramatic but also meaningful goals.
Can they do
when
that
when it comes to healthcare? Can the middle make this argument?
Yeah, I mean, can they do that? And will Democrats largely listen to that and recognize this is not an election about the future public policies of the Democratic Party, but creating a moment where we can actually affect a transition away from Trumpism and restore the connective tissue of this country, both domestically and internationally?
Well, I'll tell you, the candidate who is leading, although his lead has gotten narrower in national polls, is Joe Biden. And that is the core of his debate, of his appeal. His appeal is, I can get elected. You're not going to love me on everything, but you want to stick with me for that reason. It's worked for Joe Biden, although he's got some problems. And I think one reason we saw Klobuchar and Buttigieg really kind of step up their game in this debate is there's a sense that Biden may be in trouble. Maybe there's an opening for another more centrist Democrat to come through. Hasn't really happened so far, but that doesn't mean there is more than 100 days to the Iowa caucuses. So there's still some time for that to happen.
So you raised Joe Biden, and of course we all know the controversy that's been swelling and swirling rather around the vice president and his son, Hunter Biden, and Burisma, which is the Ukrainian mining company that he served on, the board he served on, $50,000 a month. Not bad if you can get it, right?
Well, that's approximately what you get paid for this podcast. Is that right?
Exactly, which is why I'm all smiles all the time. But the fact of the matter is it's a little bit icky, and it bothers a lot of people. But the investigations into this and the other storylines that have unfolded from it clearly indicate that there was no wrongdoing, no criminal activity involved here. And yet the president has been pressing this and pressing this and pressing this. And Joe Biden at the debate finally had the moment where he wanted to say something about it. And this is how it came out.
My son did nothing wrong. I did nothing wrong. I carried out the policy of the United States government in rooting out corruption in Ukraine. And that's what we should be focusing on. And what I wanted to make a point about, and my son's statement speaks for itself. He spoke about it today. My son's statement speaks for itself. What I think is important is we focus on why it's so important to remove this man from office. On the 17th, look, the fact that George Washington worried on the first time he spoke after being elected president that what we had to worry about is foreign interference in our elections. It was the greatest threat to America. This president on three occasions has invited foreign governments and heads of government to get engaged in trying to alter our elections. The fact is that it is outrageous. Rudy Giuliani, the president, and his thugs have already proven that they, in fact, are flat lying. What we have to do now is focus on Donald Trump. He doesn't want me to be the candidate. He's going after me because he knows if I get the nomination, I will beat him like a drum.
Too much? Not enough? What do you
think? So, you know, it's true that Joe Biden is right when he says there's no evidence of wrongdoing. There's no evidence he did anything wrong or his son did anything wrong in the terms of being illegal. But that doesn't mean what they did was wise.
Right.
And his son, Hunter Biden, has now said, yes, maybe it reflected poor judgment on his part. Joe Biden hasn't said that yet, but I think a lot of people look at this and say, why did he allow this to be a problem? Why did he speak out and become the point person on Ukraine and allow his son to be making a business relationship with a Ukrainian gas company? And that's a question I think Joe Biden has not yet effectively answered. It's one that maybe could be answered. But it needs to be addressed because it is an unpersuasive. Many Democrats worry it is an unpersuasive argument to say Trump's children have taken advantage of his position worse than my children. You know, I may be swampy, but they're swampier.
Right.
I think Democrats would prefer to have a cleaner contrast with President Trump in 2020.
Yeah, my kids may be dirty, but your kids are nasty. That's kind of what that argument is. But there is some truth to the point you make that he's not effectively addressed it in a way that people feel okay, done. And as long as there's this sense of lingering overhang, that they don't feel that it is resolved. And this is the Elizabeth Warren problem, quite honestly, with her failure to answer the question that everyone already knows the answer to. They just want to hear her say it. Yes, my Medicare plan will cause middle-class taxes to go up, but the cost will go down, whatever. Joe Biden and Elizabeth find themselves in this very murky space of trying to save face, avoid creating the clip that can subsequently be used against them. Biden by acknowledging, yeah, what my son did was a little swampy, and Elizabeth Warren saying, yeah, I'm going to raise taxes on the middle class, and think that they can move past it.
Yeah. You know, Elizabeth Warren really, Pete Buttigieg really pressed her on this at the debate, and she just dodged him. This is, it's a little out of character with her, because usually, you know, she has a real command. She has a plan for everything. That's become a big joke, but it's true. And she has a command of the details of policy that many of the other candidates don't have. She's really thought through, especially some of these economic policies, in a serious way. So I think when a politician tries to dodge a question, it looks like they've got something to hide. It looks like they're trying to play some kind of game. You're better off being forthright, even though it's a slightly complicated argument to make. Your taxes will go up, but your costs will go down. We're not always good as a society in thinking, being able to hold more than one thought at one time.
Right. And that could be a complicated thought for some people, to see how that exactly works, because at the end of the day, their overall costs may go down if you've dealt with prescription drug prices, you've dealt with premiums, you've dealt with some of the other inflationary costs associated with healthcare, to the point that when you do the offset, yeah, at the end of the day, you may pay a higher tax rate to pay for a substantially lower cost in your healthcare. And at the end of the day, you come out ahead. But, you know, guys like me don't necessarily believe that's how the economics ultimately work. But I got to have, in order to make that point, you got to tell me what you're going to do in order to have that debate. And I think that's the piece in many respects that's missing. But Susan, how do you, as a reporter, and you're a consummate professional, you've been in rooms with a very lot of powerful people, and you've heard the BS. How do you get past the BS wall and get to the core of the question, or more importantly, the answer to the question that you know your listeners, your viewers, your readers would want to know?
Well, I think here's what I try to do. I don't always succeed. Ask a short question about one thing. Don't ask a three-part question that gives somebody a way out. Say, Michael Steele, will your plan raise taxes? And then when you give me a dodge, say, thank you for that answer. That's not what I asked. Michael Steele, will your plan raise taxes? Mm-hmm. And then you give some other dodge and I say, perhaps I'm not being clear. Michael Steele, will your plan raise taxes? I think that is the thing that then sometimes shames people into telling you a direct answer to your question. Not always.
But that makes so much sense. I mean, and sometimes I'm actually screaming that, you know, just it's not a complicated question to answer, but it's certainly not even a complicated question to ask. And I think that approach is one that a lot of folks in my position, from time to time, yeah, you can't get away from something like, hey, does A happen if you do B? You know, not complicated. And you can dance around it all day long. But, okay, let me be clear. Does A happen if you do B? So where do you see the race right now? How does this play out? We've got one more debate, I guess, before we get into the silly season, which, of course, is next year's primaries season. Who do you think is going to be on or off the stage based on where things are now? And potentially, what does that mean as the run-up? Biden is sitting on $9 million in the bank. I can't believe this man's burn rate. But that's a problem. Buttigieg, all the money in the world, but basically tracking at 5% in the polls. And if they raise the bar to 10%, he's out, which I suspect they won't, because he'd be out. What do you think happens?
You know, we know that 8 people have qualified for the next debate. Amy Klobuchar is not.
Right.
Not clear if she'll make the debate stage. I do think the field is getting a little smaller and more focused. Probably voters may find that helpful. I think the fundamental dynamic of this race is that the front runner is flawed. I don't know that Joe Biden won't get the nomination, but I think there are signs of trouble for him, including the fact that he's raising less money and spending more money than his chief rivals. And the other big problem I think Joe Biden has is it is entirely possible that he will lose the Iowa caucuses to maybe to Elizabeth Warren, maybe to Pete Buttigieg, that he will lose the New Hampshire primary that follows, maybe to Elizabeth Warren, maybe to Bernie Sanders. And he's counting on maintaining his standing to the South Carolina primary, which will, he hoped, be his safety net. But we don't have a history of voters not paying attention to the first contest. It makes a difference if you win the first contest or the second contest. It makes people think of you as a winner. It makes them take a look at you. So I think the calendar poses some real challenges for Biden. So I think it is while his front runner status has been more durable than I would have expected, I think it is entirely possible that someone else ends up as the nominee.
Oh, this is going to be intriguing, intriguing. I can't wait. I can't wait. All right, so we're going to take a quick pause. Believe it or not, I got sponsors. Can you believe it? The podcast has sponsors finally.
Very, very smart people lining themselves with you.
Well, I appreciate that so much. So we're going to take a quick pause and get a word or two from a couple of sponsors, which I'm really excited about. And then we'll come back with more conversation with Susan Page. We'll be right back. Welcome back, everybody. The podcast is still going on strong, and we've got someone special in the house today. She is Susan Page, Washington Post bureau chief of USA Today, and the author of a book, which I want to get into with her, The Matriarch, Barbara Bush and the Making of an American Dynasty, and as well as the upcoming book, Madam Speaker, Nancy Pelosi and the Arc of Power. Let's start with Barbara Bush. Barbara Bush was, I think, one of the more phenomenal first ladies in modern times because she walked that very fine line between being the matriarch of a family of presidents and wife and mother, but also had some political skills of her own that she would use, if you will, behind the scenes. Tell us a little bit about the matriarch.
You know, the reason I was interested in Barbara Bush was because I thought that she was influential in ways that she made sure no one knew about. And it was useful to go back at the end of her life to look back at the things she did that she didn't previously talk about. She, for instance, she was an influential figure in her husband's presidential campaigns. And there were two occasions when George H.W. Bush, two occasions in 1988, when he was reluctant to unleash the most caustic attack ads against his opponent, against Bob Dole in the primaries, against Michael Dukakis in the general election. And she was the one who said, George, it's going to be all right. You need to run these ads. And only then did he give the okay to run these ads because she had a spine of steel and she had almost a mean streak that her husband did not have. And this was very useful to him politically. And I'll tell you, we know that as First Lady, she did a lot of work on literacy, adult illiteracy, which she cared a lot about. Behind the scenes, she had a big effort on AIDS, on pushing the administration to do more, her husband's administration to do more about the health crisis of AIDS, and by herself doing more to address the stigma of AIDS. You may remember when she went as First Lady during her first 100 days in the White House to visit Grandma's house, which was the hospice for babies with AIDS. And she picked up a baby that had AIDS, Donovan, 6 months old, hugged him. She wasn't wearing plastic gloves. She held him to his cheek. She patted his back. This was, we forget that in 1989, when this took place, how terrified people were of AIDS. They were afraid to touch a child who had AIDS. They were afraid to work alongside a coworker who had AIDS. And with that simple act, she sent a very powerful message around the world.
And I remember that moment and thinking, wow, that's crazy. Are you sure about that? You know, and because even people who were supposedly enlightened and self-aware and had the facts were still suspicious of certain types of contacts and closeness. And she dispelled all of that. She took the risk, if you will, and actually showed the nation how to execute compassionate conservatism, if you will. You know, she just brought that compassion to the table in a way that I think made her one of the defining first ladies of the last century. How did she deal with both her husband and her son being president and internally in the family where there may have been some tensions between Daddy Bush, who saw the world one way, and her son, who was doing it a different way?
Well, you know, they didn't call her the enforcer for nothing. and when George W. Bush got elected president, you remember his father said, "I'm not going to meddle. I won't give advice unless it's asked for." And right. George W. Bush almost never asked his father for advice, as evidenced by the Iraq War,
right?
Which was a very different course than his father had taken. His mother did not make that promise. And when George W. Bush got into the White House, his mother gave him a lot of advice. She praised him when she thought he was doing a good job, including after 9/11. But she was critical of him when he was doing things she thought was unwise. And the Iraq War was one of those cases, not the original decision to invade, but the course of the Iraq War. The fact that he wasn't listening to Brent Scowcroft and Jim Baker, the people who had advised his father. And it got to the point, once White House staffer told me, that he was in the hallway outside the Oval Office and he could hear them shouting at each other about it, which is pretty remarkable because the walls in the White House are kind of thick.
Right.
So unusual to be able to overhear that. They must have really been yelling. And that George W. Bush finally told his mother that he was calling the shots. He was the president. He knew what he was doing and she should back off. And I think she did, sort of.
Yeah. That's a, sort of. Because I'm sure once they left the Oval Office, which was George W.'s turf, and they got back home at the family ranch or up at Kennebunkport, it was a very different conversation. You may be president when you're in the Oval, but at my house, you're my son. Sit your behind down and listen to what I got to say. I could hear her doing it. So you talk about her with the spine of steel and sort of sharing her opinion. She did that with respect to Jeb Bush's run for the presidency, where she pretty much cut it off in its infancy, before it even really got started, when she said, "I don't think he should run for president. Basically, I don't think he'd be a good president." How was that recovery?
So this was in 2013. She was doing so it was very early, and Jeb Bush was thinking about running. He had actually, I think, pretty much decided he was going to run, but he wasn't ready to admit it. She's on the Today Show. He's watching TV, and she says, "You know, I think Matt Lauer asked, do you think your son Jeb should run for president?" She said, "I think there have been enough Bushes and enough Clintons. There must be other families." And Jeb Bush told me that he couldn't believe she was saying this. His own mother, this Republican icon, was saying there had been enough Bushes in the White House when he hadn't gotten his turn yet. So he called her and said, "What are you doing? Don't do that again." And about 2 weeks later, he's watching TV again, C-SPAN. His mother's on C-SPAN saying, "You know, I think there have been enough Bushes and enough Clintons." And he called her again and said, "What are you doing? You promised me you wouldn't say that again." And she said, "I didn't," and hung up on him. He then calls back. And it turns out that the C-SPAN interview had actually been recorded a month earlier, before the Today Show, but they hadn't aired it in that C-SPAN way. And so she had technically not broken her promise, but the effect was the same on Jeb Bush. After that, she stopped saying that. She did stop saying that after that. And when he was at the end of his campaign, not doing well, before the New Hampshire primary, he called and asked her to come up to campaign for him. She came up, she's 90, so at that point she is 90 years old.
Amazing.
She is suffering from congestive heart failure. She's using a walker. And you see her walking through a New Hampshire snowstorm with her walker, campaigning for her son, doing an ad, doing TV interviews.
Amazing.
One last campaign, but sadly not one that, sadly for the Bushes, not one that worked out for them.
Wow. Wow, amazing. So while we got a little time left, go to the woman of the hour, who has been, and I suspect will be for at least the next year, the chief nemesis to Donald Trump, and that is one Nancy D'Alessandro Pelosi. You've got a book that you've got coming out, Madam Speaker. Walk us through what that's like and what you gleaned that readers will find interesting about Nancy.
Well, I've been working on this book for most of this year. I'm still doing reporting, not done yet. I've spent a lot of time in Baltimore, mm-hmm. where she grew up. Her dad was the three-term mayor of Baltimore, a big figure.
Yes.
Tommy D'Alessandro, a big yep. figure in Baltimore, as you know.
Yep.
Her mother also, such an interesting woman, well ahead of her time. So I've been trying to explore kind of the roots of what we see playing out now, which is Nancy Pelosi's discipline and her mastery of the legislature. I mean, I really think that she is the most effective House Speaker we've seen since Sam Rayburn.
No doubt.
And you look at her, she's at this point, she is the chief Democratic counterpoint to President Trump. But even before that, she was the instrumental figure in pushing through the Affordable Care Act. So she has quite a substantial legacy already. And by the time the book comes out, I'm sure it'll be even bigger given this showdown that she has going with President Trump.
I'm looking forward to that because, as you know, I tangled with Nancy during the heyday of Obamacare when I was national chairman. And as I like to mention, yeah, she beat me pretty bad. she won that battle. She has been one of the more compelling political figures in this early century and has been a dominant force. And I have a whole lot of my favorite Nancy Pelosi stories, but none more so than the ones in which she corrals her own and whipsaws them into action, knowing, for example, that she's going to take a drubbing on her decision to move forward on Obamacare, which they really should have called Nancy Care because she was the architect of that legislation and certainly its implementation. But it does speak to the roots of the woman growing up Italian family in Baltimore. Her dad's political prowess was something that was transferred to her, I think, genetically, because she certainly demonstrates the same skill sets of the rough and tumble side of politics, which I think has served her well.
I would also say that there are ways in which Barbara Bush and Nancy Pelosi, very different figures, mm-hmm. but they are both women who came of age before the women's movement at a time when expectations and opportunities for women were much different than they are today. And both of them were underestimated, I think, in their times. Nancy Pelosi, not so much at this moment. Now I think people understand how powerful a figure she is. But there are some threads that tie them together. And Michael Steele, I hope you will tell me at another time, just between us, your best Nancy Pelosi story.
It's a goodie. It's a good one. And it's a guy. We'll be happy to share that with you. She is the incomparable Susan Page, one of the best here in Washington and around the country, the Washington Bureau Chief of USA Today. The upcoming book, folks, is Madam Secretary, Nancy Pelosi and the Arc of Power. And to wet your whistle in preparation for that book, do check out her bestseller, The Matriarch, Barbara Bush and the Making of an American Dynasty. Thanks you so much, Susan, for coming on and giving us a little bit of the current out there in Washington.
Yeah, Michael, thank you so much.
All righty. All right, folks, that does it for this week. But you know me, I'll be back because I'm like a bad penny. I keep showing up. We'll be back next time. Don't forget to check us out on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, or wherever you get your podcast on. Download. We really appreciate you. Just another shout out to Elijah Cummings. Rest in peace, brother. Rest in peace. Take care, y'all.
Your local Health Mart pharmacy is putting the personal care back in healthcare. We know you by name, not by refill number. Visit healthmart.com for the location near you. Health Mart, caring for you and about you.
I'm Alistair Campbell from The Rest is Politics.
Nish Kumar here from Pod Save the UK.
And Christiana Figueres from Outrage and Optimism.
Rising inequality, conflict, climate disaster, it's very hard to find reasons to be hopeful about the future.
That's why we're teaming up this September during the 80th General Assembly of the United Nations.
Along with Political Currency, Pod Save the World, The Week Junior, and more.
We'll discuss the stories that give us hope and answer the question, how does hope turn into action?
Look out for the Be Hope Takeover this September.
Moro Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends, with thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.